CFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Propaganda 2. The Pentagon launches its latest psychological warfare plan to take over social networking and Facebook. From phone hacking to the Leveson inquiry, on the week Private Eyes Ian Hislop took the floor. Is this just another inquiry going nowhere, just like the Chilcot inquiry into the illegal invasion of Iraq? Magdalena Krupka is from Ujima Radio in St Paul's joins us to discuss how well Bristol and London's media is serving the public, and we look at this week's stuff on the Leveson inquiry. And the European Particle Research Centre near Geneva, CERN, Sabine McNeil, went on to set up the Forum for Stable Currencies. Now she's campaigning for victims of miscarriages of justice. Her train was late last week, and we only heard about 3 minutes of her, but we've got about 20 minutes, as we pre-recorded it for this week, last week, so we'll be hearing that towards the end of this hour. But first, Martin, Syria, there's been quite a lot going on this week, particularly the Russians making it absolutely clear that they're not going to be standing for any kind of invasion or intervention by NATO in the country.
Well, yes, it's a very, very dangerous and tricky situation. There was an opinion poll this week, which is not actually a very, there's questions about this opinion poll, but it showed that 55% of people wanted the government to stay, and 45% of people are fighting to get it out. The real danger in Syria is it's going to collapse into civil war like Iraq. And the factions in Iraq, both the Shia and Sunni factions, are infiltrating their weaponry and their supporters in there. The Free Syrian Army, which is supposedly fighting against the government, the chief of that is actually a Libyan, who was actually in charge of Tripoli until quite recently. He's actually an Al-Qaeda Islamic fighting group guy.
He was in Guantanamo Bay as well,
course,
I believe.
And of course, we now know what happened in Libya was the Qatari special forces and the British and French special forces were in there. And it's all becoming clear that this is actually a war with Iran by proxy.
Now, during the week on Newsnight,
going to get very, very dangerous.
On BBC Two, on Newsnight this week, Mark Urban had quite an interesting report where they were saying, well, yes, we are holding our hands up, admit that we had soldiers on the ground, the British forces and NATO forces had soldiers on the ground in Libya up to dirty tricks, special forces and diplomats. I mean, you can remember maybe towards the beginning of the Libyan conflict, some of them were caught at it and arrested by a bunch of Libyan farmers. So I wonder, the implication there is that maybe the same is going on in Syria.
I think that's exactly what's going on in Syria.
And is there any evidence for that so far?
Well, we obviously don't know exactly what's going on. We're sitting here in a studio, radio studio in Bristol, so let's not be too definite about what's happening. It's a sad situation, and it's a civil war, basically, and that's the sad thing. And civil wars are horrible things, and nobody's in the right... I was an aid worker in Bosnia in the 90s, and the sad thing was that everybody was in the right and everybody was in the wrong, and everybody was in a mess, and that's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I lived in Northern Ireland for a while, and you certainly see there's two communities. They're living together, but they're apart. It doesn't take a lot to set one against another.
No, and in Syria, you haven't just got two communities. You've got several communities. You've got Kurds, you've got Christians, you've got people who fled from Iraq. Most of the Christians fled from Iraq to Syria because Syria was safe. It's not safe now because the Sunni insurgents in Syria are the same as the Sunni insurgents in Iraq, the ones who bomb Shia mosques. And, of course, what's actually happening is it's all manipulation by the big powers.
Well, we've seen a lot of Syria almost every day on our TV news. My question, though, is, are we getting an accurate picture through the big networks?
No, we're not. We're actually being deliberately lied to. For example, we're being told that these are peaceful demonstrators who are being shot by the government, but actually there's a Free Syrian Army that's shooting back with supported by the SAS. Right, OK, that'd be the way of it then, wouldn't it?
OK, well, moving on to our other story. This is about something called Propaganda 2. And this is an article called Propaganda 2 and the Rise of the Narrative networks from George Dvorsky on something called the Sentient Developments blog, posted towards the end of last year, which I dug out. The US is working on something called narrative control of narrative networks. That is to say, it's looking at the power of social networks. The Pentagon is, anyway. Something called DARPA, which was, I think, probably 30, 40 years ago, started developing the internet. And they're saying that in the first 18-month phase of the program, this is a massively funded Pentagon program, the Pentagon wants researchers to study how stories infiltrate social networks and alter our brain circuits. One, this is an actual quote from the Pentagon, one of the stipulated research goals to explore the function narratives serve in the process of political radicalization and how they can influence a person or group's choice of means, such as indiscriminate violence to achieve political ends. Now, this sounds like really does deep psychology. They're trying to find out exactly why people will see something on the internet and then go out and actually take political action.
Well, yes, I mean, they spend millions on this kind of psychological manipulation. And as you know, Tony, we met a British Army psychological warfare expert last week, who we won't name. This is what's going on all around us, but people think that it's all just news. It isn't. It's manipulation.
Ultimately, though, do you think it's fair to do this kind of thing? And is it, I mean, because it's not actually illegal, is it? To, I mean, for example, one of the things we saw during the Libya conflict was that there were certain individual people that appeared as Facebook personalities that didn't exist at all. They were actually manipulated by the intelligence services.
Well, what's beginning to happen is we're beginning to realise what's going on. So they, when they pull a trick, they can pull a trick. Like they pretended that the rebels had taken over Tripoli, and the Qatari television, Al Jazeera, showed pictures of people taking over Green Square in the centre of Tripoli, but they were false pictures. Now, you can do that once, and but you can't do that again. Nobody's taking Al Jazeera seriously now. We know it's propaganda. And it's, the same thing happened in Poland during the communist era. If you tell lies, nobody believes you. That's the end of it.
OK, now we're going to be talking about Leveson in a minute. But first, over in the Forest of Dean, something called the Wilderness Centre has been for the last 20 or 30 years educating young people all over the Forest of Dean. But Gloucestershire County Council has decided to sell it, to close it and to sell it. But the local people, led by someone called Tom Forrester, who you're going to hear from now, have occupied the building. And it was on the front page of the Gloucester Citizen at the beginning of last week. So I went over to the Forest of Dean and had a chat to Tom, and here he is now.
My name's Tom Forrester, and we're in the Wilderness Centre. It's a recently reopened environmental education centre in the Forest of Dean. It's reopened, there were children here being educated, so it's open in that sense. We're working with the council trying to negotiate with them for a temporary permission in the interim period, because it's going to be abandoned for a number of years, I'd argue, if they're going to sell it off, if they're going to push that ahead. It's going to be abandoned for a few years at least, so we're hoping the very least we can do is educate children during that period and keep it open for that time. Why have I decided to do this? On a personal basis, I came here as a child and I was educated here, so this is a centre that I have a deep emotional connection to. I believe that it's not really an option to keep these centres open or to close them. It's an absolute imperative that we keep them open. In these times of uncertain ecological and economic circumstances, we need more environmental sustainability centres. We need more education about sustainability and alternative technologies available. We don't need to be closed in the few centres that we have.
But the Gloucestershire Council will say, look, sorry, but we just can't afford it.
The Gloucestershire Council say a lot of things. They say they're closing this place to save £45 million. The guy that used to work here said that they want to sell this place to reinvest the money that they make in the youth, which is a lovely little kind of like twist of logic there. I have no doubt that they want to save money, but I don't really want to get into the economics and the banking kind of side of things, because a lot of people know how that system works now, and it's all about moving forwards after accepting that knowledge and finding its real solutions, not reiterating and going over the intricacies of our banking system and how massively corrupt it is. I think most of your listeners will probably know the circumstances we find ourselves in, and I'm really about growing food, educating, moving forward. I've got no interest in talking about what the council are saying about saving money.
So tell us about your experience when you were educated here. What was that like?
Came here with several groups, I remember, just around the fire that we're sat around at the moment. I remember cooking basic bread on sticks and hovering it over the fire. The Cubs, maybe, or something, some small group. I've lived around this area for quite some time, and it's always been a place that you can walk through, you can have a couple of herbs from the herb garden, you can admire the views. So it's been a very open place. It feels less open now that there's some security guards posted by the door, but people within the forest stream will walk where they want to walk. It's very much in the local culture here, so I'm glad that we've seen plenty of people that are just walking up to see what we're up to.
Now, there's lots of youngsters in this area who are being educated in schools in an ordinary fashion. Why do they need somewhere like this?
Well, I guess we're not really educating the same things as the schools, and definitely not in the same way. Different children require different techniques to educate them. They learn better in different ways. We're probably geared more towards the learning through practical means or learning through a variety of means than the schools, which is very kind of like you're taught to remember something and then reiterate it on command. You're taught to memorise facts and then regurgitate them onto a sheet, and that decides where in the bell curve you appear and thus your future career. Yeah, we're not so much about that. We're more about trying to elevate every single human being, trying to kind of find how a human being works, how a child learns, and try to gear our education to that.
I mean, most of our jobs are urban jobs. They're in the cities, in offices and things like that. And what's the point of educating people in a place like this about the wilderness and about forestry, about agriculture, that kind of thing?
The environment we're in at the moment is closer to man's natural environment. Living within a city, I mean, I've only lived in a city for a couple of years, but I know how that affected me coming from the Forest of Dean before. I think we all need to reconnect with the wilderness, reconnect literally with our roots and our past, and to take from that what we can, take from that a connection to nature, an understanding of where we come from, an understanding of who we are, and how do we expect our children to tame the wilderness within if they can't be within the comfortable within the outside wilderness, if they can't kind of relate to the plants and the animals.
But one of the things people learn in an education centre like this is names of trees, names of plants, animals, fungi. Is there any real advantage of that? You know, because it seems as if that natural world is a bit disconnected from us nowadays.
It is disconnected by a few months of food storage. You know, this country used to hold, I think it was 5 or 6 months of food storage. I believe we now only hold 2 or 3 months. We saw not very long ago when the fuel carriers, the people that transported fuel, were on strike, how quickly everything ran out in the shops. We don't really store much food anymore, and there's plenty of agendas at play that ensure that we don't store a lot of food. People, if they're hungry, will be turning back to the wilderness, turning back to whatever little wild food we can harvest pretty quick if anything happens. So having a knowledge of that, it expands our minds in that we learn about what we used to eat. That food doesn't just come from a bubble-wrapped container from the supermarkets. It comes from an actual place, and those places, quite a lot of them are endangered habitats at the moment. So if you can eat something in the woods and you know that your food is secure because it grows in the woods, it brings in an element of wanting to protect that habitat, wanting to save the few remaining habitats that we have left that are really fully established, or if we've got any of them left. I think there are a few patches of established woodland, similar to how they were after the Ice Age around here. But countrywide, we used to have been, I think it was 95% woodland. Now it's one of the worst in Europe in terms of tree coverage in England. So we need to, in my opinion, re-green the land, rebuild the Garden of Eden here.
Well, that's Tom Forrester from the Forest of Dean. Sounds like he wants to cover the entire country with trees. I'm not sure if everyone would agree with that, but certainly by taking over the Gloucestershire County Council's Forest of Dean Young People's Education Centre, rather than allowing it to be closed down, sterling work. Martin, what are your thoughts about this? Because, I mean, environmental education is crucial, isn't it? And what they're doing is they're just kind of wiping it out. And this looks as if this place is just going to be sold to the highest bidder. I wouldn't mind betting one of the mates of the county councils has already got his eye on it.
Well, yes, and people are standing up for what they believe in and having a go. They're not necessarily going to win, but it's always better to fight.
This place has got an incredible view over the Severn estuary as well. I mean, you know, one of those million pound views in this case. Ultimately, is there any kind of real way that these things could be maybe passed on to a trust to run it if the county council doesn't feel it can afford it anymore?
Well, it comes back to what we were talking in the first hour about macroeconomics. We shouldn't be cutting public expenditure and closing down facilities like this. It's idiotic.
Okay, thanks very much. Well, I'm now joined by Magdalena Krupka from Ujima Radio. Hi, Magdalena. Welcome.
Hello.
To Drive Time.
Thank
nice
you so
to have
much.
You on our station for a change.
I know.
Can you just tell us what you do over on Ujima?
Yes. Well, first of all, I want to say that I am not representing Ujima today.
No, but your program on
but
there.
Yes, yes. I am a breakfast presenter on Ujima. I do the breakfast show with Magdalena every Wednesday and Thursday from 7 to 10. So 3 hours of good music. And of course, every time I'm trying to prepare all interesting topics. And I'm trying to make it as positive as I can, which is not an easy job, because looking for positive topics and optimistic topics nowadays is a hard work.
Well, I tell you what, I've got another negative topic for you. At least you could say it that way. That's the Leveson inquiry,
yes,
into media ethics. Now, it started off as a phone hacking inquiry. It slowly moved over into a sort of parade in front of the TV of various celebrities. So what are your thoughts about how it's gone and where it's going?
I am very skeptic about all inquiries, government inquiries. I am not against them, let make it clear, but I've seen such inquiries in my country, in Poland, and really, it doesn't look like they're looking for the truth, but it looks like some kind of, you know, theatrical entertainment thing. And yes, I'm not a very big fan of inquiries like that, but then it's a very important subject, you know, ethics and morality, especially in press, is something we should talk about, and I believe we should change many things, because I want to say that when I came to England, it was 6 years ago, I was really shocked about English media, because when I was studying journalism in Poland, I've learned that British media are the best, you know, they very you know, open-minded, and they very professional. But then I came here, and when I was shocked in a good way, but also very shocked in a bad way. Especially I'm talking about tabloids now. I couldn't believe my eyes that someone can do newspaper like that, with all this colorful, you know, some of them horrible pictures of, you know, celebrities and the subjects they're talking about. I found it, I'm going to be honest, I found it disgusting. Honestly.
But don't the readers get what they want? I mean, surely the press barons are serving up what the readers want.
I'm not sure if that's what readers want, because I'm talking with people and they say it's too negative. We want, it's not reality. Reality is not like that. And okay, if you're talking about something imaginary, you know, situations, tell it, this is not true. But they pretending this is reality, this is true. But we all know it's not like that. And especially, you know, tabloids, they're showing something which people, I don't know if people wants to see that. But if they're showing something which is not reality, they should say it, instead of saying this is truth, this is what it is.
Well, we had this week Ian Hislop, the editor of Private Eye at the Leveson Inquiry, with a bit of a breath of fresh air, saying, funnily enough, almost what you were saying, which is that a lot of the things that are being discussed at Leveson are superfluous, because the phone hacking itself was itself illegal. So let's have a listen to Ian Hislop now, speaking at the Leveson Inquiry this week.
Statutory regulation is not required, and most of the heinous crimes that came up and have made such a splash in front of this inquiry have already been illegal. Contempt of court is illegal. Phone tapping is illegal. Taking money from policemen taking money is illegal. All of these things don't need a code. We already have laws for them. The fact that these laws were not rigorously enforced is again due to the behaviour of the police, the interaction of the police and News International, and, I mean, let's be honest about this, the fact that our politicians have been very, very involved in ways that I think are not sensible with senior News International people. And I hope you'll be calling the Prime Minister and Tony Blair and Gordon Brown to explain how that comes down from the top.
Now, that was is being really pointed there, saying that maybe the wrong people are being interviewed by the Leveson Committee. You know, why don't they talk to Mr. Blair, Mr. Brown and Mr. Cameron? Of course, Cameron's press secretary, Andy Coulson, who was right at the centre of Downing Street and yet seems to be, allegedly, the mastermind of this massive criminal hacking operation.
Yes, that's true. I do agree with that. And I wanted to also come back to what I said before, because I said I was shocked in a really bad way, but also I was very shocked in a good way, because when I first discovered The Guardian, I was like, oh my God, you know, how it possible that they can talk about such a controversial subject and they've got so much information about it. And then when this Leveson inquiry came, you know, to the light, and we find out that journalists are hacking into emails, they're hacking into voicemails, and that some kind of made perfect sense to me. You know, when I saw this kind of information they show into people, they read it, they watch it every day, you know, there was something really strange about it, and not moral, I would say, not ethical. Because obviously, you know, think about yourself. If you got your letters, yeah, some letters, and someone is checking them, you wouldn't like anyone to do that, yes? It's the same about emails or voicemails. This is not the way to get information. This is absolutely wrong. And every student who studied journalism everywhere in the world, they're saying this is not right.
Well, maybe what's going on here is that because people don't trust this newspaper, they won't volunteer information to it. So it has to go out and steal that information.
But this is not right. And I wouldn't like them to do that. That's obviously just my opinion, but I prefer, you know, to not have information from such a source.
Yeah, well, that's, I think, certainly what's been going on.
Yes.
Anyway, let's also have a listen to, there's a chap I had an interview with this week called Granville Williams for the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom. And I asked him about local radio and the Murdoch empire, because 2 years ago, Rupert Murdoch successfully lobbied to have big cuts in the BBC licence fee. So let's have a listen to Granville Williams from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom.
He had James Murdoch 2 years ago launching a vicious attack on the BBC, saying it was too big, too powerful, and it had to be reined in. David Cameron agreed with it. Shamefully, Ben Bradshaw, who was then the Culture Secretary for New Labour, also grovelled and said, yes, yes, very important speech. Because, of course, the News International Titles supported Cameron in the general election. The payback was, you got that disgraceful and, in my view, totally illegal attack on the BBC, in the sense that, first of all, the World Service has got to be funded now by the BBC. Secondly, money has got to be put into local media initiatives by the BBC, and the licence fee is frozen. Now, let's be clear about this. The BBC is funded separately from all other forms of the cuts to public services that have been announced by this government. It's a separate issue. And yet, and I think disgracefully, Thompson, the Director General, agreed with this, when Cameron and Osborne said, you've got to bear your share of the cuts, well, of course, the BBC licence fee had nothing to do with the cuts, and yet it was lumped in with it. And I think there's an action which, as I say, was a payback to Murdoch for supporting Cameron in the election. One of the problems is the BBC has been forced, because of this licence fee settlement, to make cuts in BBC local radio. Well, BBC local radio is valued. It's how people find out stuff about their local area. They have phone-ins where people can express their views. It's highly valued. It's completely different from what we're now seeing with many of our local and regional papers, is they're cut back, journalists are sacked, and you get a poor product, which is not giving us the local news we want. So my argument is very simple. The BBC, in all sorts of areas, in terms of its local radio, in terms of its online services, in terms of its national programming, it delivers material that people want. By the way, the interesting example is, do you know what the most watched program is on Sky? It's BBC One.
Local radio that we used to have, I mean, here in Bristol, GWR, has completely disappeared, and it's been swallowed up by national companies who are applying for these local commercial licenses but actually broadcasting nationally. So how has that happened?
This all goes back, I mean, to my media historian. I carry a lot of baggage in my head, and my memory is of what used to be commercial local radio until it was demolished, beginning in the mid-80s with reform. I used to listen to Radio Piccadilly in Manchester, where you'd have journalists employed to do research. They did documentaries, radio documentaries. We've seen the hollowing out, and because there's been light touch regulation, it's been allowed to happen. And most of the news that's on these commercial radio stations is now supplied, guess what, by Sky. And therefore, you're not going to get local news on it. And also, of course, the rules on media ownership have been relaxed so that all of these, what were GWI, which was owned by the Daily Mail, by the way, GWR at least did have some sense of locality, even though it was heavily committed towards playing music and with a minimal amount of local news, but it was a regional radio. That's all gone. You've got very big national groups which have a minimal amount of what we would call hard news or journalistic content.
That was Granville Williams for the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, really talking about the demise of commercial local radio. And I'm also joined by our station manager, Phil Gibbons. Phil, we've seen lots of changes over the last even just 5 or 6 years. We've had Galaxy, we've had Star. These radio stations, the commercial local radios we share the airwaves in Bristol with, have changed massively over that time.
Yes and no. The names have changed, but whether the actual stations changed, that's the thing. See, what happened? Independent local radio failed. You just mentioned Piccadilly there, or your guest mentioned Piccadilly, which I believe started in 1973 from the top of the tower. One of the first commercial stations, GWR, not too far behind a few years later, which was the old Radio West, of course, where the likes of Trevor Fry and Eddie Shoestring, there we go, he worked for Radio West. You won't understand this, sorry. Probably didn't make it to Poland, Eddie Shoestring.
But, really, that's true.
But GWR was one of the first sort of commercial independent local radio stations, if we can say that. It used to be based down at the Watershed, if you remember, Tony, down there. You could actually watch the shows going out and look into the newsrooms and things. But then they cottoned on to the idea that actually there's a lot of money to be made in commercial radio. It then became commercial radio, which by definition, the name is to sell commercials, advertising, let's make money for the shareholders. And GWR, one of the first big groups that cottoned on to, if we buy up all these smaller stations around, then we can make money. We can centralise everything in Bristol, ultimately in London when they got bought out themselves by Global. But let's centralise everything and get people like Graham Torrington on doing Late Night Love, one of the most listened to programmes of the 90s. It was fantastic. But you could listen to that on 38 different radio stations every evening. He had a bigger audience than Radio 1 at that time, but it was still local radio. It's just that those local stations were owned by one big group, and that group at the time was GWR. We were lucky that it was based in Bristol. It's not anymore because they got taken over or merged with Capital Radio and then became Global. So the stations have always been there. It's just that they've changed. And more recently, Jack FM and Star, as was. Star is now The Breeze because it's owned by a station called Celador down in Southampton, which, funny enough, also owns Jack. So our other two smaller local stations, Jack and Star, now Breeze, are owned by a company in Southampton. All the admin, all the sales, everything is done a little bit in Ashton down the road there, but most of it down in Southampton. I could go on.
We're certainly. I mean, what we're seeing is a real consolidation. It's only surely a matter of time before this Southampton-based company maybe merges with Global or they take their own.
Oh, absolutely,
over.
Absolutely.
Because the rules are being cut down over the last 20, 30 years. To begin with, the idea was that a local commercial radio, anyway, was local. So why did it fail, Phil?
No, it didn't fail. It should have worked, and it is working because, we have Ujima in the studio here, along with BCFM. I know you're not representing Ujima, but you're putting glamour into the studio anyway. Let's just say that.
Community
radio is thriving because of the demise of local commercial stations and also local BBC. Let's not forget those. I know your beef with the... your impartiality, shall we say, Tony, with the local BBC. But they're committing suicide as well. Local is local. We have to stay local. Independent radio, commercial stations, it was all about the money. When the sales started to dwither a few years ago, they centralised to London, and their argument to Ofcom was, we cannot... Bush and Troy are fantastic. Let's not take anything away from Hart's breakfast show, Bush and Troy, but it's a small audience. They want big names. They want the Chris Moyles. They want the Chris Evans at breakfast. They can't do that to have that in Bristol, to have that in Manchester, to have that in Birmingham on their hearts. They need to centralise all their breakfast shows to attract the big names and pay them £10 million a year like the BBC do. So the only way Chris Moyles or somebody like that will jump ship and go commercial is if the audience is there and the money. The audience won't be there and the money won't be there unless they centralise. It's basic economics. We should get Martin in to talk about this because he's more intelligent than I am. But that's the way. So these local ones couldn't succeed. They lost their localness. They saw the bigger picture. Let's get the big names on. Let's sell bigger national advertising for longer and blow out the localness. It doesn't work.
But they're actually, what we're seeing is a slow dissolving of the diversity. There used to be hundreds of different stations, yeah, of these commercial stations. And Magdalena, maybe you'd just like to comment on what that means. If you've got a less diverse news outlets, particularly local news or, you know, ways of interpreting national news, what does that actually mean?
Yeah, I think this is definitely wrong, all this. That's what's happening, you know, because the world is ruled by the money, you know, the concentration of the money, concentration of the power. But let's not forget that there's 99% of people who thinks in a different way, that we diversity is the way to go. If you go to the forest, if you go to the jungle, it's not like one kind of trees, one kind of birds. You've got diversity, and that's what it is. That's what it should be. And if you got different point of views, we talked about it before, that if you got one subject, you're going to ask different people, get different answers. And it's not like one person is right, one person is wrong. No, all the views, they're making the whole image of what's going on.
What about with something like the big nuclear accident and the tsunami at Fukushima? That's quite a good example, I think, of something where even, as you were saying, you have evidence that even the local people over in Japan weren't satisfied with the service that the media was giving them. At such a crucial moment, it broke down.
Yes, I spoke with one girl from Japan, from Fukushima, actually 60 kilometers from a nuclear plant, so from the village. And I talked with her. She's now traveling all around the world because obviously she doesn't know how long she's going to be living, she's going to be on this world. So she decided to go and travel and see the world, you know, because she can now. But she told me also that most of the people there are really afraid because they cannot get an opinion from government, from people they usually expect to get the truth. And they know that they've been lied many times, and especially in situation like that, when they need help the most, they're not getting it. And this is very stressful and frustrated for them. But I think this is not the first time in history, you know, not only Japan, but everywhere in the world. And unfortunately, this is the way it is now. But I hope that it's going to change. Everything is changing. If you believe that this is, you know, the way it is and it's going to be like that forever, you're wrong, because everything is changing. So this will change as well.
Well, one of the particular problems with the Fukushima problem, the plant, was that TEPCO, which is the operator of, yes, the plant, they were told, this is something like 8 months before, that they had to close the plant down. This was something from the International Atomic Energy Authority. It advised them that it was a very dangerous place to put a plant with a fault line very close by, and they were told you've got to close it down until it actually reaches the safety standards. Now, that was never made public, only through WikiLeaks.
Yes.
and unfortunately, you see, so maybe it's one of the reasons that the government is not giving information out properly is because they're actually afraid that maybe someone will be pointing the finger at them.
Yes, but let's start from the beginning. Nuclear plants and getting energy from such a way is not safe, because you produce energy, fair enough, but also you produce toxin, you know, and peoples, all scientists in the world, they don't know what to do with them. So they cannot say this is safe. They cannot say that they've got safety policies, because it's not true. They're obviously lying to people.
Phil, what are your thoughts about the future just here in Bristol?
Don't ask me about Japan.
Coming down. No, just zooming into Bristol, okay, for a minute. Do you think that there's a possibility? I mean, we've got Jack, they do news.
Yeah.
Do you think
they
that there's
well.
A possibility that that there will be more diversity? Because the problem is with the BBC is they are, at the moment, they're having to suffer really what is the after effects of Rupert Murdoch's and James Murdoch's lobbying 2 years ago to cut down the local broadcasting.
Don't you think what you've just done in the last 6 or 7 minutes exemplifies who we are and what we do. You started off talking about the demise of commercial radio and tried putting Japan to rights and nuclear energy. You know, I think that was fantastic, and that shows the strength of local community radio. Even though it's a national story, an international story, there's always a local angle. You have an opinion on it. I don't know quite so much. I'm not as intelligent.
Well,
as,
we've got
as
a local, the possible nuclear power station, well, new one being built down the road here.
Exactly.
We?
You can always localise a national story, and as long as local commercial radio and local BBC becomes regional, then it's going to open the door for more community stations like ours. You know, what we do it well. What you do superbly well. Different audience, we're different audience. Let's have an Asian station, let's have a gay station, let's have a kids station, let's have a Christian station. You can get these on the internet now. And don't forget, Tony, I'm not going to answer your question because I've forgotten what it was. But, you know, it doesn't matter the platform you can listen to it on, but content is king. If I want to find out something, I can go anywhere. I mean, you surf the net all night long. I know you do. So you can find out your conspiracies. You can find out people's opinions. And that's the way it's going. Don't even start on local TV.
Well, one final thing I'd like to just talk about is the SOPA Act in the United States, the Anti-Piracy Act, which it looks like through mobilisation through Facebook and other things has been actually killed off this week. But one wonders what would have happened if it wasn't an election year for President Obama, because it's basically him that's killed this by saying, I'm going to veto it if the Congress passes it. So what are your thoughts about that one?
I have to say that, you know, some people believe that 2012, that's going to be a year of changes. Yes. And they say that people who got power now, they can feel it. And that's why they're so desperate. So now they want to mobilize it even more. They want to get as much as they can. And I'm not sure if it's true. I'm not saying yes or no, but we can see with our eyes that something is really going on, something strange, that they're not heading to the direction they should. And obviously, always, you know, political campaign and propaganda, it was more, you know, vivid when it was a time, election time. So that's, I think that's perfectly makes sense to me.
Okay, what about you, Phil, on the internet censorship by the US? Do you think they'll ever succeed? I mean, I'm sure this isn't going to be the last time that the big media in America tries to close the internet down in this way.
Well, what they tried doing years ago, slightly different but very similar in a way, they tried to get rid of internet radio in America by saying it was illegal to broadcast from an American IP to America. So what happened, this is about 15 years ago, what happened, you had all these pirate internet radio stations getting offshore IP addresses to broadcast back. Let's go back 50 years, shall we? Before we go, Tony, can I just invite Magdalena to our Polls Aloud event that's happening at the Colson Hall this Sunday between 5 and midnight. It's a celebration of Polish music, life and food as well. And Pidanatsa
Pidanami
are coming all the way from Krakow. They're flying in. Thank you very much, Tony.
I'd like to wind up. I'd like to wind up by looking at what the internet was originally for, because it was developed as a defence system against nuclear attack.
That's true.
And one of the things that they used to say, what they say about the internet now as a communication network, is that the internet senses censorship as damaging the network and roots around it. And I think what you say, Phil, proves that point. Yeah, I wonder if maybe these big corporations trying to lobby for laws like this, they're just banging their head against a brick wall.
You know, but you know what they say, that there's no free internet and there's never been a free internet. So obviously, you know, it's nice to dream and think that, you know, that would be nice. But no, it's all commercial and it's getting even more commercial. You can see even, you know, when you got a Facebook, like millions of people got Facebook now. And the way it's changing, it's just ridiculous, isn't
it? Big brother, that's what
yes.
it is. It's so they can glean as much information about us as possible. Facebook, MySpace, all of these. It's also they can just send marketing to us and make more money. You're quite right. Yeah, absolutely.
But I think we shouldn't get too crazy about it. And if you know what's really going on, you can prevent it. You look at things and, you know, you're looking like through your hand. You see only what you want to see and you ignore what you know is not good for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think knowledge is very powerful and people should know about it.
Knowledge
so
is power.
Magdalena, can you recommend us a good internet website to go and get news on? Just one that you've found.
But
that
that's what we are talking about today, that diversity, that's the way to go. So there is no one website you should go.
But one that you would go to, say, if you were going to have a look on the internet for prepare your show or whatever, one that maybe isn't so well known, but that you found that's been quite interesting.
There is one website I quite like. It's called Optimist World.
Optimistworld.
Yes, optimistworld.co.uk. It's a bit boring because they do only optimistic news, but then it's something, you know, totally different. You've got like two sides, you know, of the coin. You've got tabloids and then you've got, you know, only good news. So this one, but on the internet, there's a lot of really nice pages when you can find good news. And I like such a
news. Okay, finally, can you just remind us when you're on the radio?
No.
No.
No, she can't.
Yes, she can.
No, she can't.
I told this already. But yes, you can catch me every Wednesday and Thursday from 7 a.m. to 10 p.m., of course, on Ujima.
Okay. Phil Gibbons and Magdalena Krupka, thanks very much for joining us.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, the European Particle Research Centre near Geneva, CERN, she was in last week. Sabine McNeil from there went on to set up the Forum for Stable Currencies. Now she's campaigning for victims of miscarriages of justice. And also, as we'll hear next week, she's getting bizarre anonymous phone calls.
My name is Sabine, which is German, McNeil, which is not. I came with this vision of a peace network of people and computers protecting our planet once upon a time. With my training as in mathematics and computing, I just loved growing into the web and the internet. And now I get my hits and kicks out of the number of visits to the number of websites that I keep building. So one of the trademarks that I'm wearing is Publicity Online, where I promote especially victims of white-collar crimes.
Why have you chosen to do it all online?
It's more effective and efficient. I used to organize meetings at Westminster to promote monetary reform and to kind of help people wake up to the evil of national debts after I met Lord Sudley. And Lord Sudley told me how his story was about the bankruptcy of his family 100 years ago. And I said, well, when we heal your family, we heal your nation. So I organized these meetings because he had planned to organize a conference but wasn't very good at it. And I felt after 10 years of meetings, I hadn't gotten anywhere. So I now reach far more people online than I could ever reach in by organizing.
I find that quite surprising. I would have thought that if you're meeting in the Palace of Westminster, well, that's where things really change, isn't it?
They ought to, but my perception and observation is that everything looks okay and hunky-dory, but what really happens is in the corridors. And I attended lots of select committee meetings in the House of Lords as well as in the Commons. I've made oodles of submissions, but you just make history by your report being published and nobody cares. Nobody takes notice. Things go on as business as usual.
What were you actually lobbying for at the time? This is the Forum for Stable Currencies.
At the time, we were trying to point out that and how the creation of money has been completely taken over by private banks, gradually but surely, and that the solution is the monitoring to the ratio, the proportion of cash versus credit, because banks create credit, whereas governments create cash. But by now, there's hardly any cash in circulation. It's all credit, 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 and nobody creates the interest. And the worst and evil treason, in my view, is that central banks sell their credit to governments. So governments have sold us out completely, and this is all over the world, ever since the Bank of England was started in 1694.
Well, you would have thought that the governments and maybe people from the Treasury, etc., would be interested in what you had to say and be thinking about possibly changing their policies to take a bit more of a proactive, shall we say, approach to policy.
Yes, one would have thought, but what they say is one thing and what they do is another. And if you've got a treasurer who is part of the Rothschild Empire, then I think you have a kind of a conflict of interest. And I just really feel by now that the agenda that is being followed in terms of policy is entirely not in the interest of the people.
So why is that then?
Because there is what one calls a global elite that controls what is happening worldwide. And that is an elite of people who use money as their main controlling mechanism.
Now, Martin Summers, Old Labour Oxford economist, you're with us too. Can you tell us what you think of what Sabine's had to say? Because she's proffering there a solution, or at least some solutions, to the lack of money and the fact that the public, through the democratic process, don't control the money system at all.
Well, I think these are ideas whose time is starting to come. I mean, Mervyn King, who's actually the head of the Bank of England, even he made a speech not long ago saying that we have to look at the fractional reserve banking system. He, of course, is more of a bureaucrat than a banker, actually. The Bank of England is supposedly a nationalised institution, although, of course, it has become independent of government control because Gordon Brown made it so. And there are a few countries in the world which still have non-private central banks. But, of course, even publicly owned central banks are open to pressure from private banking interests. So the large root of the crisis that we're in is the credit creation by banks, which has got no control. The governments don't have any control over it. So, of course, they basically create massive amounts of credit because it suits their book. Then they crash the economy and create all kinds of problems for people.
So, Martin,
governments are not really in control of the process.
You're saying exactly. that maybe the time has come for policymakers to start listening to the sort of things that Sabine had been saying.
Absolutely. And I think the problem with most change only comes about when there's no other alternative. Institutional structures tend to be rigid, and they only change when change is forced on them. And that's true even of good institutional structures which are well designed. And these institutional structures have been designed with the interests of the global elite in mind. So they are not going to give up their power without a fight. And the only way they're going to be shifted is if they are seen to be grotesquely mismanaging the economy.
Well, I think that's where we're at.
Ordinary people are beginning to realise that they're grotesquely mismanaging.
It's fair to say that bankers aren't the most popular people nowadays in society, Sabine.
That's certainly true. And the key is it's not so much about bankers as it is about central bankers. And that's what people do not realise, the difference between credit at the scale of national debts compared to credit at the scale of companies and individual debts.
So what's the difference then?
The amount, at the scale. And the key is that nobody creates interest. And so everybody has to borrow to pay interest. That's effectively what's happening.
Can I just comment on that? I mean, it is central banks which are the mechanism. But what happens is the private banks create as much credit as they like, and then they go to the central bank and get the central bank to back up what they've done. So the central bank ends up... I mean, the theory is that the central bank creates a minimum amount of cash, if you like, and then the bankers elaborate that into credit. In actual fact, the private banks create as much credit as they want, and then they come back and have that ratified by the central bank. And it's a private interest setup. I mean, the Federal Reserve in the United States is not... It's about as federal as Federal Express. It's federal in name only. It's not controlled by the central government. It's not controlled by any democratic forces at all. And they are in the pocket of Wall Street, basically. They always have been. And, of course, they present themselves to the public, and even in economics textbooks and economics seminars, the Federal Reserve is presented as if it is a publicly owned central bank, which it isn't. It's a private enterprise setup.
Yeah, and it's amongst my studies, I was quite shocked to read that economics was effectively set up as a pseudoscience to cover what banks and bankers are doing and have been doing. And that's why I come in as a mathematician,
Proper scientists look at so-called economic theory and say this is just ridiculous.
Yes.
But what's also very bizarre is that the derivatives market is staffed with people who have got mathematics degrees and physics degrees. And, of course, they're very good at writing very, very complicated formulas like the Black-Scholes theorem, which supposedly gave an absolutely foolproof way to price all stocks and shares. And what I would say as a historical economist is these people aren't economists. And their mathematics is way above my head, but it doesn't really matter that I don't understand
it
because
it's
wrong.
What you two seem to be both agreeing on here is that economics is a kind of dark art.
It is, and certainly. Because the very, very simple essence is exponential growth. That is not a mystery in mathematics, but compounding interest on interest is exponential growth. And this myth about economic growth is effectively always a growth of the money supply. And the money supply is the sum of credit and cash. And after World War II, in the UK at least, the ratio was about 50-50. But now we've got 97% credit and 3% cash based on guesstimates, because nobody can really ever create the proper statistics.
The derivatives market is guessed to be possibly 12 and possibly 200 times bigger than the official market.
Yeah.
Nobody knows, because it's a dark market, and there are deals that are done which nobody realises what those deals imply, which is why when the credit crunch happened with the collapse of Lehman's in 2008, everybody had a complete panic, because nobody knows what these lines of credit actually look like. Nobody knows. Not the people who wrote the derivatives, nor anybody else. And the guess has got to be that they've actually basically overwritten it by many, many times. So the crash, when it comes, is going to be catastrophic. It's going to be like nothing we've seen before.
Now, Martin is famous for saying the crash is coming next week for the
Not
last
next
two
week,
years.
But it's coming.
For the last couple of years, Sabine, what's your view about that?
I don't believe that the crash will be coming, or that any crash will be coming. Crises, yes, because people are not good enough at planning globally together.
Because the problem is, of course, that banks, as we've seen in the United States, can just continue to lend and extend credit and extend credit longer and longer, as long as they want.
Yeah.
There's a kind of power there in that they can extend credit to certain people or other people, people they like, they extend credit to, people they don't like, they don't extend credit
exactly.
to. The other thing is, which is also a really important factor, is that they can actually then just click their fingers and write off that debt if they feel like. For example, that's one of the things they've been doing in the biotech industry.
And debt is enforceable by law. So the legal aspect is, if you like, the firewall that protects this creation of money. And that's where I look after the victims who are made bankrupt, whose companies are dissolved fraudulently. And it is absolutely shocking to go into the stories of solicitors and lawyers who help this process, where court documents are falsified. So money has a dishonest source, has become so dishonest that we only can kind of feed dishonest people
now.
Can
you just tell us about one or two of those cases?
I'm just completely still under the shock of the child snatching cases that I've just heard in Wales. And in my experience, child snatching is the tip of the iceberg of white collar crimes. When I got into it, I asked for people which are the worst bankruptcy cases, which are the worst home repossessions you've come across. And we turned them into two books called The Forensics of Legal Fraud. If you Google for that, you'll find volume one by Mr. Ebert, who's been involved for about 17 years as a fighter for justice in his case. The other one, the woman has died whom I helped, and her two companies were dissolved. An extraordinary manor house was taken from her, and she died with nothing, absolutely nothing. And so I learned to believe what nobody can believe, because you can't imagine that such bad things are going on.
Well, in the first case, we can read about it in the book. Tell us a bit more about the second case. What were the circumstances surrounding that?
The second case has also turned into a book. That's volume two of The Forensics of Legal Fraud. And the worst is possibly the fact that the woman had a partner who said, "You can't do anything to me because the police are my mates." And that's the truth.
That was Sabine McNeil there, who was also in last week. Her train was a bit late, so we had her on. And we'll have a bit more from her next week too. Sabine McNeil runs something called the Forum for Stable Currencies. And her website about the victims, I mean, so she started off in money reform, but now she's looking at miscarriages of justice. Her website on victims is called victimsunite.net. That's victims-unite.net. And she's got something on there at the moment, just arrived, the next court hearing of Mr. Ebert in a criminal court. So what she's doing is just really following some of these controversial cases, what she believes anyway, of miscarriages of justice. Well, that's the serious talk out of the way, because Friday night is music night. 2 hours live now with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party crew, followed by the UFO show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Conservative Councillor for Avonmouth and Group Spokesperson for Transport. That was Siobhan Kennedy Hall. Also to Eugema Radio's Magdalena Kropka, and to Phil Gibbons, and also to our old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, Southmead Hospital PFI, as North Bristol NHS Trust goes foundation status, we talk to French Aid Trust's Chief Executive Ruth Brunt. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including this programme's 5-point economic recovery plan, and analysis of Easter's Tesco riots, as well as investigation into leadership charity Common Purpose, and an inquiry into the 7/7 London bombings, by going to bcfm.org thisweek.org.uk and finding the Friday Drive Time page, or even easier, thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and our archives. A podcast of this show is online normally 10 minutes or so after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. We have about 65 million people in Britain and 65 million acres of land. So while it might seem there's not enough resources to go around, that's only because banks and big business have hijacked far more than their fair share. All we have to do is make sure the 65 million acres is shared out fairly, and with modern technology, not controlled by a power elite, we can all live happily together. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.